Welcome to another episode of Backlash Podcast. It has been, I would say a little while. I can't remember the last time I would use the word legend, but we have a new legend on the podcast in Larry Dahlberg. He is, as you'll learn from the conversation, there's almost no fish he hasn't chased, and there's almost no place he hasn't chased it. Definitely a very cool conversation. I always look forward to these just because, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love talking to anglers of all, you know, types, young, old, but I really like the old ones because of how much change they've seen and how different things have been progressed. You know, me as an angler, I've always known sonar and I've always known certain things with my musky fishing. I've always known braided lines and, you know, good reels and all this other stuff. And like, they've just seen so much and they had to adapt so much throughout the course of their fishing careers that it always blows my mind. They also have a very much different way of thinking, as you'll hear in this conversation, from setting ladders up in boats, Brad, to, you know, watching polarized glasses to essentially the 1980 version of forward-facing sonar. Unbelievable stuff. Really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he brings a lot to the table. It's always incredible to talk to Larry. I've had the opportunity to do that over the last, 18, 20 years, and shared the boat with him many times, Jeff, and he always seems to blow my mind with, maybe it's a thought process, maybe it's an experience that he's had, or his ability just to think like a fish, I guess, is the best way to put it. And you know, I've watched some of those come to fruition in the boat where I show him a certain kind of bite, he shows up with a bait, and we accomplish some tasks that way too. So, incredible angler and a very wise, intelligent human being, that's for sure, Chuck.
Yeah, for sure. Excited to have him on this week's, you know, as this week's guest. We'd love to get him back on again. I think we just barely scratched the surface of the intelligence that he has. And he thinks like a fish, basically. He takes things to a whole nother level. Brad, you and I had a conversation after we got done recording with Larry, and he took it to a whole nother level there as well that we didn't even get on, you know, on the recording. So just awesome. I love those conversations. I love talking to, like I said, I like talking to anglers of all shapes, sizes, skill levels and whatnot, but I particularly love these types of conversations. So that was a good one. You know, Brad, sounds like, you know, maybe your musky season is going to potentially start sooner, but first you're going to go on a little hiatus. That's why we're a little early on this podcast. What's going on for the next couple of days for you?
Well, honestly, Jeff, my musky season should have started for me since I was in cast already, but the weather has not cooperated with us for down in the south, southeast. And so I've been kind of stuck in the shop, but we are going to take a little hiatus here for 3-4 days. We're going to head to Cabo, and it sounds like there's a bunch of marlin going. So we're going to do that for 3-4 days down in Cabo. And when I get back, I think I got a week or two, and then I'm going to head back down to the southeast, weather permitting. The last thing I want to do is go spend 3 days, 4 days, whatever it might be, fishing muskies where we can't film when we're so busy in the shop. So kind of had to put that on hold, but looking forward to getting on some musky water here shortly.
Very cool. I hope you guys have yourself a great trip. You know, but before, we'll cut this one short because, Brad, I know that conversation took up some time and you got things to do before you hit the road. So let's just dial up our conversation with Larry here in 1 second. We got to do it. We do it every week. If you're looking for gear for your next musky fishing adventures, make sure you check out TeamRhinoOutdoors.com. And make sure you also check out Brad and Carrie at MuskyMayhemTackle.com. That's the shortest I've ever made it, 8 seconds. So there, let's go dial up that conversation. All right, our guest this week is none other than Larry Dahlberg. I would say we haven't had what I would call a legend on in quite some time, and Larry would definitely fit that legend status. He is many may know him from the Hunt for Big Fish. In 2017, he was inducted into the IGFA Fishing Hall of Fame, and I even read an article that claimed, Larry, that you were the Michael Jordan of sport fishing. So, I mean, it doesn't get much more high praise than that. Thank you very much for taking time to come out and talk with us today.
Michael Jordan.
That's what I read. I read the article.
I'm waiting for a tennis shoe deal, that's for sure.
Yeah, I bet you it pays more than fishing does.
Well, you don't judge your wealth by how much you have. You judge your wealth by how little you need. I learned that from an old guy on the top of the Himalayas, kind of at the base of the Himalaya Mountains. Anyway, my career at fishing started really early. I was hooked as a little kid. I remember the first time I saw a bobber go down. I was ice fishing with my dad, and it was my line, and I pulled it up, and my dad was hollering, and the line was landing on the stove. I didn't realize. But I caught the crappie. And then early memories, my dad would bring home these great big muskies, and I would look at them and just shiver. And they had teeth. And I guess I just wanted to go along so bad. And then my dad would take me along, but I had to be able to muster. So before I could go along musky fishing, I had a Fluger scale cast and a little 5-foot rod. And it would get me behind the house, and I have to cast over my head under the swing set into a box 8 out of 10 times before I could go along. When I was 6, I could do it. And I got to go along. That's when I learned how to row. And time went by, and I spent really a lot of time on the water. An old man died. They called who was a guide for a private fly fishing club up here. And they called my dad saying, hey, help, you know, Charlie died, and Mr. Pillsbury's coming. We need a guide. And my dad said, take the kid. He knows who the bass are. And I got a tryout. And every time I told Mr. Pillsbury, cast right there, there's a bass, he caught one. Because I used to go down the river, I'd climb the trees, I'd throw crayfish in and stuff, I'd see where they were at, because you didn't have Polaroids out back then. And my old man had let me go for 2-3 days all by myself down, you know, camping. So I had kind of a more personal connection with a lot of these creatures than the actual old guys that guided. Because they were walleye fishermen mostly, you know, and they knew the best banks and the, you know, that rocks always got a bass. But anyhow, I got a full-time job after that. I did it for many years. I ran the camp going through college, and then there was a hiring freeze on. Actually, these guys wanted to make me a U.S. senator by the time I was about 17. They had me. This club consisted of some very, very high-level people, heads of president of Coca-Cola, the president of ADM, head of international for General Electric, old Mr. Pillsbury, some really, did I say president of 3M also? But anyhow, Vietnam came, blah, blah, blah. I was going to go to work for 3M Scientific Anglers Fly Fishing Division. But there was a hiring freeze on. Jimmy Carr was president. And the guy said, I go get some retail experience. And there was a store opening, Burger Brothers. I got a job there. Took Bud and Ted Fish, and they made me the tackle buyer. I did that for several years and then went into the rep business. And from there, I didn't understand. The wholesale guys just hated me because I had gone around them when I was a buyer for Burger. But then I became a rep, and then I went to work for the wholesale thing because I didn't understand parts of it. Just kept my rep business. And that was pretty successful. And then I got an opportunity. I got a phone call from Roland Martin or somebody. No, Spence Petros. And Roland Martin had been up sniffing around here trying to catch something. Been up for several weeks. They hadn't had much luck. So I took them fishing, and we did pretty well. And then they called Al Linder, called me up, and I took him fishing. And, you know, we did a thing with sturgeons. We were, I think, just tagging and shocking. And then Al went fishing with me and then offered me a job. So I took, I think, about a 300% cut at pay. Went to work for the InFish thing because I wanted to learn the media business. I learned the distribution side. And then wound up producing their TV show and did that for a while. And then decided I wanted to see the rest of the world and the professional walleye trail and all that stuff was kind of, I don't like the tournament thing. I don't get too many anglers in one place. It makes me nervous. And I went on and I did the hunt for big fish. It took me to 89 countries. And I just had a lot of curiosity about things. And pretty well satisfied that curiosity. Now I'm back home again. I spent a lot of time in my workshop designing lures and messing around, trying to figure out how to get one of these things to prove we both exist. That's all.
Larry, you kind of hinted towards the end there, but early in your career, I guess I'd call you the godfather of Flashaboo. And Flashaboo is obviously dear to my heart because it's kind of provided Carrie and I a whole living. Maybe talk a little bit about that and how that came apart together.
Oh, man, dude, I don't know if I ever even told you this story. Okay, I'm a little kid, and Mr. and Mrs. Daniels, that's Archer Daniels Midland Corporation, ADM, supermarket to the world. They would come up and fish, and there was a bet, first, biggest, most, $1. And this Mrs. Daniels, and it was all fly fishing, Mrs. Daniels couldn't cast a fly 15 feet and had never caught a bass. And she'd been fishing up there before I ever even started guiding. But she kind of liked the little kid, and she's the old lady. I'm a little kid. They put us together. And throwing a popper, you know, like 10 feet, good luck. So I tried to give her a spinner. You know, they were made in Prescott, actually. Prescott, Wisconsin. And was, they called it a Yellow Sally. It was a single hook, some chenille on it, a little teeny spinner. It was made to cast with a fly rod. But, you know, Mrs. Daniels, she's going to kill us with that thing. And so it was always bothering me. Well, my mom was, we grew up real poor. My mom had been in Minneapolis, and it was before Christmas, and she bought this really super cheap Mylar tinsel you put on a tree instead of the expensive, heavier stuff. And I remember reaching up, and I missed the limb, and I watched it go floating down the tinsel. And I thought, huh, that would be a great spinner imitation. So I threw it down, you know, put it down in the basement, and that spring before Mrs. Daniels came up, took a hook, put some pencil cork on it so it would be neutrally buoyant, because I didn't want, you know, she'd get hung up. I mean, she never paid attention, and anything that sunk, you're going to get hung up with going through the rapids or something, she'll get hung up. So I need something that doesn't float, just girl. Did that, and then I put some chenille over it, put a shock of this tinsel on it, and then put a muddler kind of a head in the front to make it so the, you know, turbulent. Put it in my box. Mrs. Daniels shows up. I think it was in probably mid or late June. I go like hell down to the best place I know, the Big Rock Pool. We flip that thing out and we swing it across, and a bass comes up and hits it. And she kind of jumps in her seat because she'd never had a bite before. She didn't know you were supposed to jerk. And eventually we end up hooking one and another one and another one. And she started tearing match heads off of her matchbook. She was a smoker. And then she ran out of match heads, and then she started tearing little notches in the matchbook to keep track of how many bass she was catching. They were just little 11 to 14 inches, but it was like a big day. And then she wanted to smoke. I didn't have any matches. So we go down the point of the island and where we're going to meet for lunch, and she's jumping up and down, waving her arm. She needs a match for her cigarette. And that day she caught the first and she caught the most. And she never lost the bet again, all $3 anyway. And years later, I had figured out a head called a diving head. You can't make with a fly, you have to make something you can cast, you know, with a fly rod. So aerodynamics are really important. And I figured out a way to make a diving head. And what it was, a way to deliver Flashaboo, you know, to a underwater, you know, surface blue. And I took a guy named Dave Whitlock, famous fly fisherman, and he was using all these beautiful flies. First 10, 20 minutes, we didn't even get a bite. So I dropped the anchor and said, I got to figure out what's wrong here, you know, and I took out a what's known now as a dog or diver with a what's known now as Flashaboo tail, threw it out, and, you know, a couple of strokes, and blam, a bass hits it. He thought, what's that, a trick fly line? I said, no, it's a head. He said, what's that stuff on the back? And he said, man, you got to share this with the world to make a deal with you. If you give me the rights to the fly, the diving head thing, what you call it, for a year, and then you got to figure out a way to package it, come up with a name, and so on. And I'll help you market it. And I'd skipped a spot, an important part. When I was about 15 or 16, this is when, you know, this was going on. The local bait store guy called and said, there's a pro fisherman coming, you know, called my dad, and you should bring Larry out and meet him. So I go fishing with this guy from St. Paul, Pro Fisherman Inc. And it's the first time I'd ever seen a depth finder. They'd just been invented. And it blew my mind. We went on this lake that we were fishing for walleyes, but there's no walleyes even in this lake. And we'd gone over the basin and saw this hash on the locator. And so there's a crappies. I wish I had a crappie something or other. Well, I always carried a bag with me that had a bait casting rod, a fly rod, and a spinning rod. And I dug out this bag and put my fly rod together. It was a homemade 10 weight, 3-piece herders I built when I was 11. And I fired out a great big long cast. You've never seen anybody throw that much fly line. And I had a little fly made it with this tinsel on it, you know, the tinsel fly we called it. Few strokes and bam, bam. I'm starting to catch crappies like crazy, just bing, bing, bing. And then I said, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I worked with him to develop a much stronger material that was more flexible and didn't degrade in the sun and so on. And he started a lure company called the Tinsel Tail Lure Company. And he was putting up on a little tiny stool. So anyway, I worked with him to package this stuff, and I came up with the name Flashaboo, and we started a little company. And that's where you and Carrie bumped into it at Thorn Brothers, I think. And she went home and made the first cowgirl, and Hammernick found it hanging on the wall at Mille Lacs and went out after the tournament and caught a bunch of muskies. And I guess the rest is a history of a bunch of fish with small holes poked in their jaws and the taste of Flashaboo in their mouth.
Yeah, it's pretty wild how this kind of all unraveled, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing. And I remember you calling me the first time, and I had no clue that you had any involvement in the Flashaboo market.
I never wanted to get pigeonholed as like the InFish guys wanted me to write and do all the fly fishing stuff in the magazine. Well, hell, you know, I'm pretty good at fly fishing, but I only fly fish 5% of the time. Man, my grandpa fished with night crawlers and, you know, dead meat. My old man only fished with lures, and I bounced back and forth between them and only guided a bunch of fly weenies. So I was looking, you know, I had a little bigger universe. I always look at the world of angling as a sphere with a billion keyholes in it. Most people only in their life get to look through a few of them, and man, you want to look through as many as your lifetime allows. That's what that thing I sent you, that vault. And, you know, that's to me the secret of angling, if understanding that term, that German word. I break it into three things, man. It doesn't matter if we're fishing muskies or if we're fishing whatever. You've got mechanics, strategy, tactics. You got fish you can see. You got fish you can't see. You got fish that eat each other. You got fish that eat bugs. You got fish that eat both or either. And then you got to think about natural selection versus imitating some abundant forage that they're locked into. And, you know, you go from there. Main thing that you got to start out with that you can control is mechanics. And, you know, that's gotten easier over the years. I used to have to be able to thumb a bait caster and not get a backlash. You know, that mechanical issue has been pretty well solved as far as being able to, you know, mechanically move your boat in the right place. That's been somewhat solved with the spot locks and all that kind of thing, right? We used to have to be able to go out and make a map ourselves in our head. If, you know, now you can, you know, buy a depth finder with a map in it. Things have changed, gotten easier mechanically.
Well, you're not wrong about that. Just a little bit ago, you talked about the very first fish finder that you ever seen.
Yep.
What's your thoughts on some of this new equipment right now? I mean, obviously, a hot topic is the forward-facing sonar. But honestly, I think we're dumbing down as anglers. I mean, you're talking about climbing trees.
We're dumbing, we're dumbing down as freaking humans.
That's a good point. Solid.
What would you do if you lost your cell phone, if you lost your blank, 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 blank? How long would you survive? Do you watch Naked and Afraid? Well, I mean, we're talking to people who are fully clothed and fearless. But anyhow, that's a whole nother topic.
You're not wrong. It's pretty amazing to think. we're just so far away from nature and from where we began, that's for sure. So
yep, that is for sure.
I got to laugh at Larry's comment though, you know, with the we're dumbing down as humans. So like I listened to Larry talk, and you kind of alluded to it, Brad, you know, talking about him climbing trees and throwing crayfish in, and I'm thinking to myself, man, if we like, it would be so fun almost to have like a legends versus, you know, whatever. We'll call them millennials, but I don't want to use that as a derogatory term. It's just, you know, younger anglers, I guess I would say. And just like, just watch them battle it out, because like, in my opinion, and I don't want to take anything away from, like, we'll even say my generation, Brad, like, these guys are so much further ahead just in their thought process and how they just feel more in tuned with the surroundings than what my generation or most anglers today are. You know, it's just crazy.
Well, that's the bottom line is they had to be, right? And I'm on that fringe where technology really started taking over, right? I mean, I've talked about it on the podcast before. I think one of the biggest changes was MapGuard, right? Everything that I had spent time learning, now you could buy for $100. So it's just, it's amazing. But I think some of the older anglers that had to learn boat control without any of that definitely makes a difference.
Well, of course it does. I mean, you've got two things here. There's the natural world, and then you've got the, call it the synthetic world, the digital world. One of them's real. The other one is. And as humans, you know, even if you approach the natural world, most people approach it, you know, you think about a fish or a deer or whatever, you look at it through your own eyes rather than looking at the world through their eyes or their ears or their senses. And as anglers, that's where we really, I think, go wrong.
You know, talking about this, Larry, and maybe this is a little off topic, but one of the things that I remember fishing with you, and you did it 3-4 times, I believe, in the boat, and I don't know where some of this footage is. I'm not sure if the Hunt for Big Fish is it out there and available on YouTube, Larry?
Nope.
It's not. Okay. Well,
oh, I'm sorry. I just tucked it away, and one of these days I'll put it out. I just been kind of just relaxing and fishing since I quit filming.
There's a lot of cool episodes, and I know I have some of the DVDs. Maybe those are still available. Are those out there, Larry, for sale?
Yeah, you can get that online somehow.
Well, one of the things that I remember fishing with you, and it still blows my mind today, and I have been able to duplicate it once, twice. I can't even say a handful. But I remember being in the boat with you. You had created this bait. I don't even know what it was called. It had the lead head, which is how we arrived with the grenade. I mean, that's where the grenade was created, yeah, that we made, yeah, today.
Yeah.
But it had antennas on that lead head with some blades off of it, right? And a bunch of plastic.
It has to do with directional drop, directional fall. And what had happened, don't you remember, I'd come over there and you guys got on, you and Jason. But the fish were just being dickheads because they were, you had a slow roll. It was real. There was a little fringe out in 22, 24. I forget exactly, but somewhere like that. So you had a slow roll and then bring the baits up vertically. And the fish did not want to convert. And I've seen it before with other species, muskies, so on and so on. But we got fish. But on the way home, as my cameraman's, you know, checking the footage, the camera had screwed up. And there was a bunch of hash over the top of the most important stuff. So I had to come back, remember? And you guys were really busy, but it was like waiting a week, and I had time to think about it. So yeah, I get up really early, as you may know. And so at about 3:00, I was up in my workshop, and I built a head and I brought a bunch of blades with me so that I could figure out a way. I didn't want it to drop. How can I explain? You can't have it just hover down like a helicopter bait. You have to have it walk head down and then dive. And it has to dive faster than whatever it took to get him to come in the first place. And you can govern that by the size of the blades if you've got a fixed weight on the head. Okay. So what we did, I built that. So when they'd come up, instead of trying to make them turn the corner, you hit the button. And a muskie or a pike, and many of these fish, they can't see below their nose. They're built to look up. So when you get that thing to drop below their nose, they have to react. It's like, oh shit, you know, it's even worse than turning a corner. And so that's why they bit, and that's where that came from. And on that same note, incidentally, and this is really interesting, you will find this very interesting. The way those arms are set up, it's just the way it is. If you accelerated it and you had the arms, if you bend the arms, they're just close enough. When you accelerate it, the arms come together because of the resistance of the blades. It has to do with the stiffness of the wire, the length of the arms, and the, you know, angle of the V. But the blades actually will impact each other. And if you look, you can look and you'll see the beat up blades. I looked at it, I thought, what the hell, you know, I've had lake trout beat up lead and look like this, you know, what the heck? And then I realized, oh, it's the blades in together. And we took the underwater mic. And when you accelerated that bait and those blades hit, it sounded like china breaking, falling out of the cupboard onto the floor. And so then I thought, that's interesting. So I molded those same blades, the ones you guys were using them. I can't even remember. They're kind of a turtleback type thing, but it could be any, you know, blade, not much larger, usually than a six or so on this double setup. You know, as you probably already figured out, there's a certain kind of a range that makes sense. But anyway, I made some out of out of urethane, clear urethane, and then put, you know, color of various, you know, reflecting in them. And then I made some out of a 90 durometer rubber. And the sound, the difference in sound when they whap together is so significant. One is clickety clatter, almost sounds like those fish calling things, you know, that they sell. And the rubber makes this low thump kind of a thing. Really, really interesting. And it can be, you know, you can take that arm set up and there's a whole bunch of different ways that it can be incorporated in all kinds of different things. That's really, yeah, I remember it very well.
Well, amazingly enough, Larry, I still have some of those original heads. And
I left that with you. I wanted you to make them. I thought the best name was the Double Wubble.
I remember that too.
I think I still have it. It looks like crap. The ones, it looks like a bunch of tangled up silver pubic hair with these two blades hanging. I've got it hanging on a, you know, wall with a million other baits. And from a distance, it's the last one anybody would pick out.
Well, it was good stuff. It was the first time I ever seen muskies eat on the drop like that. I mean, jig fishing, things like that. Yeah, maybe, but.
That's different, though, because there's bottom contact involved with that. And that's a whole nother story. The right. Jig fishing thing jig fishing for sleepers, both pike and muskies is fascinating. There's a thing in your brain. You and I've got a deal called a suprachiasmatic nuclei. It's got to do with sleep. Okay. And then like in the morning, like if I would wake you right out of bed or better yet, you wake up in the morning and you smell smoke, you're headed for the window, you smell bacon frying or you hear, the sound of sizzling, you wake up with your mouth watering, but it still takes you a sec, you know, where am I? A fish doesn't have that. So they can be absolutely dead asleep and absolutely completely awake in a millisecond. Which is a very interesting thing, especially when you have bug eaters and stuff. But
yeah, I mean, think about that, Larry. I mean, instantly, if you wake something up like that, I'm sure there's a startling side to it, but they're going to react, and no different than us. So I think that's a valid point. I just think it's so cool. I mean, where you went with that whole experience was really, really good. And I mean, literally, that's where the grenade idea came from that we're building today. So
you got to try putting some of those, try different materials on your spinner blades and your grenades and keep track of whether they're as you accelerate, whether they click as you accelerate them, you know, play around with the length of the arms of that thing. and you'll hear it and feel it. But you only want it, you want it to do it when you accelerate it, so that there's both a change in speed and a change in sound that happens simultaneously. And making it turn a corner, a change of directions also, I think is, it just triggers, you know, every little bit helps.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, you did a bunch of studying with a bunch of different baits, Larry. I know that you played with the cowgirl in the tanks and you set up a microphone of some sort in a tank.
No. Tanks don't count.
Okay.
I set up an oscilloscope and an underwater microphone in a swimming pool back in when I worked for Berger Brothers. Muskies Inc. had about 35 members or something back then. And we used to do the meetings. Actually, we opened up the Berg. But anyway, man, I tried to do it in a pool and was like, what the foogity wook, you know, because I wanted to see oscillations, because we've got our hearing goes from, I forget exactly the dBs, but it's really short range compared to fish. You can hear way, way lower than we can. So in order to know what's going on, you need to have an oscilloscope in addition to a something that you're listening to as a human, okay? And in a pool, it was absolute hash crap, somewhat harmonic, and because it's a pool had square sides and it's made out of concrete, and sound travels almost five times faster underwater than it does in the air. So imagine taking a cement block room and going start yelling in it. Well, so what I did is, I got a real mic that goes way beyond the human hearing range, and then we do it in a natural environment. And what really is quite interesting is how the bottom content, whether the bottom is made out of rock or mud, affects, and the depth affects the sound of a lure. The sound of a lure, especially like a cowgirl, is affected by how far it is away from the boat and how fast you're reeling. Why? Because the guitar string is getting shorter, and it's a tight guitar string compared to a lure that doesn't pull as hard. What's a guitar string? Your line. Your line makes some more noise than most lures if you're jerking it and whipping it.
Yeah, that's amazing. How about this? How about hair between marabou, flashaboo, all the different materials that we're using with skirting today?
Sound?
Are you seeing there?
No, I don't see any sound difference now.
Okay,
I was curious. That's a real good question. Hooks clattering against a lure are so loud you wouldn't believe it. You know, as opposed to, you know, people put a rattle in a crankbait that you want to bounce off the bottom. That's sort of like whispering at a Kiss concert.
That's amazing. It's truly amazing stuff that you've learned. I don't know where else to go with that. I mean, what are some of the other things that you noticed?
I don't know. I forget. I'm getting so. I've been playing with a bunch of stuff. I'm just teasing you. I look at a lure. Everybody looks at lures. Oh, is that ever a cool color and a paint job? I don't even see that. What I'm looking at, I want to know specific gravity. I want to know center gravity. And then I want to study the control surfaces at speed based on where the connection point is.
It's a whole different world, Larry. I mean,
it's a lure. A crankbait is an upside down kite in the water. The lip is the kite. The body's the tail.
Makes sense.
That's how it is.
Well, I wish I knew what you forgot, Larry. I maybe you don't forget. That's the one thing that I know about you.
Well, I don't know. I think there's probably something wrong with me.
Well, I don't think that. You know, your intelligence is at a different level, put it that way. It's always blown my mind to speak with you, and it's always enjoyable because I come away pondering a lot of different topics from all over the planet. So it's good stuff.
I think you went back. You were talking about I've been getting a real kick out of the forward facing sonar thing. Part of my whole theory, and the reason I've been really lucky, I guess, in traveling around the world, I'd have 10 days to, and I'm on my own nickel. I got to produce, and I was stupid enough to do a hunt for big fish instead of a hunt for, you know, to hope I could catch something in a weird place. But anyway, what I've always based it on was, you know, I've got a kind of a method, you know, and I'd tear around and I'd want to look in the shallow water first, get up high, put a stepladder in the boat, lock her down with a ratchet strap, get up, go as fast as I can allow, and the light is good. And I want to cover as much territory and look at it as I can with my eyeballs and a pair of polarized glasses, okay? Well, when polarized were first, I remember before they're invented, okay, and I'm pulling a boat down through some rocks. I got the president of Coca-Cola with me. His name is Crawford Johnson, Roman numeral 3, and he's wearing these goofy looking glasses, and he's telling me about them, and I'm saying, well, I don't really need, I can tell where the boils are, and you know, Bluffy said, here, try these. I put on these polarized lenses, and I went, holy shit, excuse my French, I couldn't believe it. If I was in shallow water tearing around, I'd rather have a stepladder and a pair of Polaroids than I would any of the side-finding devices. And there's a number of reasons why. Because I can actually see the fish, I can see my lure, I can, you know, blah, blah, blah. So should Polaroids be illegal? The fish still have to bite. And it's up to us to have proper handling techniques and regulations that make it so that we don't abuse the privilege of catching these things, and to argue about technology. Well, do whatever you want. You know, the beauty of fishing is that you don't have a guy with a striped suit and a whistle. You don't have a ball. You don't have a guy with a clock. You don't have, you know, you can sit there and watch a bobber. Or you can go learn the name of every bug, or you can take it to any level you want. You can do it all day, all night. You can actually become part of that natural world instead of inventing some synthetic crap to, I mean, the reason we invented sports and stuff was to be able to get better at combating either our enemies or fighting off lions or whatever it is. It's just practice for the real thing. And, you know, fishing, it's a real thing if you want it to be.
Yeah, that's true. So I got to ask you, you know, being that you've been, I think you said 89 countries that you fished in. What is the hardest?
I've fished in all of them. I've been in 89. I've fished in an awful lot of them, but not every single one. Some of them I just had to get to and through to get to where I was going. I've been to Africa like 28 times. I've been in every country in South America except one. But it's mostly species I was looking for. And environments. That's a thing. That's another really important one. Really interesting. Well, one of the most interesting observations that I've made, it was like one of those eureka moments. Okay, what was really most important contribution that the guys at InFish made was putting together the work of Buck Perry with calendar periods and lake classification, right? But especially the calendar period stuff in fish movements. When you get to a certain place, as we begin moving from Minnesota, as we move south, or if we're in Argentina and we move north and we get closer and closer and closer to the equator, the whole seasonal game changes. Instead of it being driven by temperature seasonal changes, it's driven by high and low water seasonal changes. And so substrate becomes often more important than the temperature business in terms of dictating where fish have to wind up. And then they also spawn multiple times, you see. That's why the substrate is important. And so you have water levels like in the Amazon basin. In the Amazon, at Manaus, it sometimes varies vertically 60 feet. It's really interesting. And then you've got other places where the vertical drop, it's just really interesting. The whole environmental deal is so, so, so interesting. And it hasn't ever been written about or anything. But you guys would find that interesting if you had time.
Well, maybe that's your next challenge, Larry. Maybe you need to write a book. I mean,
yeah, actually, I had a buddy, Cesar Calora. I'd run into him in Brazil, and he was just a kid. He was a real young guy, really competitive and really athletic. And he could always get up earlier in the morning because I had a cameraman and all that. He'd get going. And we were on this houseboat and he was beating me. You know, I could tell he'd been there before because he's with a guide, but, you know, he's fishing just bam, right the best places of the best. And, you know, what you and I might call spot on spot stuff. And he'd make sure to hit it, make sure he was hitting everything before I could. But he's only got wood choppers, you know, and the stuff they fish with down there. You know, everybody uses the same stuff. And I've got wide glides, Mr. Wiggly's, bunch of stuff that I had made. So I'm fishing behind him, just kicking the shit out of peacocks, and it's driving him crazy. But he's like really good, as I found out later. Anyway, we make friends, and he ends up coming fishing here with me. I go down to Suriname, fish with him. He ends up building a great big tackle store. We go catch. He's got rivers. They fish these little creeks. We get on this big giant river, the Quarantine. We go 300 miles upstream and catch a catfish that's the biggest one ever caught in history. It was like 400 and something, 8.5 feet long. So he builds a camp there with a guy who'd owned some land, had a plane. Everything's going great. And they're landing one morning and they crash and he died. And our plan was to build that. He spoke five languages, created a local television show. He had filmed with me a whole bunch of times. You've maybe seen him, Cesar Calor. He was on the hunt for big fish many, many times at the end, fishing wolf fish. He introduced me to the wolf fish. But after Cesar died, I said, that's kind of when I retired from it. But he and I had plans to, I was going to produce the thing and he was going to be the guy. But yeah, I probably should. But I need a little more inspiration. Maybe I've got one of the, there's some name for whatever my problem is. I'm sure I can't remember what it is.
So what is the hardest fish to catch and why? You've been everywhere.
Oh, that's a really interesting, because hardest, a lot of times, like muskies, for example, let's take that. A muskie can be a very difficult fish to get to bite. Well, once he's on the hook, with the gear we use, he doesn't really present too much of a problem. There are other species, let's say a tarpon, in the right place at the right time with the right stuff, it's not difficult at all for one to get to bite. But once they bit, your problems begin. So which is harder to get in after you hook one, or which is harder to get to bite on the hook? A lot of it depends upon so many things. One of the most fascinating was the Aeropyma.
Somehow I knew that's where you were going to go. And I believe I know the reason why, but I'm going to let you keep unraveling that.
Yeah, the Aeropyma is that. The largest bony freshwater fish, the largest one I know of was 660 pounds, actually. In a year, Cesar and I captured some little ones that were as big as hot dogs. And in a year, one of them was almost 90 pounds. And one of them was about 75. And they just ate like crazy. And anyway, I'd heard about him. And Stu Apt, you might remember that name. He's a real famous fly fisherman, Stu Apt. I think he's still alive. He was an airline pilot and flew all over and did all this exotic stuff. He wrote a deal in Outdoor Life years ago that I'd read as a little kid. And these things had just torn into shreds and that couldn't be, you know, it's like this crazy story. Well, what it turned out was is they really didn't even get any of them to bite. But they had to make up a story. And I went down there and I'd see them rolling. You see them roll. Boop, boop. And people didn't catch them except you catch a few smallers. And then when they're spawning, they'd get defensive. Then, you know, sometimes, you know, you'd have anglers talking about catching them then. But mostly what I'd be peacock fishing, I'd see them rolling and really you'd throw a lure and they never did anything. So I ended up being able to, there was some park that they had. There was a bunch of them there. And I watched them and I timed them. And they were coming out like every 20 some odd minutes. And what it is, they've got an auxiliary lung. And part of their way that they can survive is when everything else dies from lack of oxygen in these ponds after the water has receded, the Aeropyma start eating the fish that have expired due to or are expiring due to lack of oxygen, you know, little piranhas and on. And anyway, then I got in this little boat that they had that was like an 8-foot long hollowed out log. They let me do it. It was at a park, just asked them, you know, if I could film it. And I went out and I you know, went where they were. And incredibly, they started coming up about every 15 minutes more often. And what it was is they were agitated. And more often that they show doesn't mean necessarily that they're feeding. It just means they're sort of spooked. And then what I really noticed is they'd roll. And, you know, if you and I would see a fish roll, we would automatically, due to our instincts, cast maybe 10 or 12 or 15, depending on how fast the roll was, ahead of where you saw it roll, right? Well, these things, when they roll, like, and they were just dropping right back down to the bottom. So after making that observation, and then also learning from met this guy that was a rancher for, he raised these things and was selling them to the Japanese for just huge money. I learned that if you make any noise, just talking, doing anything, that it spooks them and they don't like to bite. So just shut up. And that's what we did. And then we caught them, and that was that. They're very, very interesting. You have to be really careful with them. Even like a 100-pounder, you barely touch his gills, just barely lift the littlest bit, and you'll hear a little, and he's gone. Because they grow so fast, they're still cartilaginous. If I go baby tarpon, when they come up and shake, sometimes you look and their gills are detached because they have shaken so hard they've broken those.
Interesting. Well, yeah. I've always heard it's really hard to locate them. And then once you located them, you could make them bite. I guided a bunch of Swedes 15, 18 years ago, and one of them traveled the world trying to catch them. So he did finally accomplish that task, but basically he said that it was just always a struggle to locate them.
Now that wasn't hard at all. I know there's really a lot of them. It was just systematically watching the damn things, and when I figured out what the deal was, pretty much catch them at will.
Right. Interesting. So another question, what's your favorite species to catch and fish, you know, if you had one to pick right now? I know that muskies hold dear to your heart, but I'm curious if there's another species out there that you would prefer to go after.
Well, if I had one day to fish, there's no question that the greatest game fish probably is a tarpon, from a standpoint of once you've got it hooked and he's, you know, doing stuff on the end of your line, they do everything but roar. And sometimes the real big ones sound like they roar. You can catch them in any kind of environment. They use every single marine environment. I've caught them hundreds of miles upstream in fresh water. The biggest ones are in West Africa. I've got some documents of fish that are 385 pounds tarpon. A tarpon, just because they leap and they grab. Well, what happened to hammernick? Okay. Remember?
I think it's kind of a poison, that's for sure. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, a lot of muskie anglers have jumped into that tarpon game. And I mean, hammernick took it to a whole different level, right? He just totally.
I warned him. When I was first fishing over there with him, I remember he was so excited. Remember, he was the donut eating machine. He had those, they're loaded in a box like a bullets. They're little round, covered with white dust donuts. And Hammernick goes down the lake, you know, just putting them in his mouth, chung, 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 as he's motoring, sort of like shooting an automatic 22 with a clip in it. And he's all excited because I said, I don't give a crap. You can fish in the front of the boat. I'd be more than happy for you to fish in the front of the boat. And he's excited because usually, you know, he's got to be in the back of the boat. And I was throwing some goofy stuff and I'd hooked something and had a fish. It was just hooked with one hook, you know, on the corner of its mouth. And I was letting it swim around with my thumb on the reel, and Jason was, you know, grabbing the net and getting sort of excited about, like, geez, you know, it's going to get off if you don't. And I didn't think it was going to get off, you know, so I just let it swim out a little bit. And I told him, you know, Jason, you know, just what I said to you, if then a muskie bites, the problem, you get unhooked, and then the problem, you know, like you get tarpon, then you got a problem. You get this excited about a muskie. You go run into tarpon, you're never going to get back in a boat again to fish muskies. you'll never be the same again. I wasn't. And he went down there and did a little tarpon fishing, and he sold his muskie gear and so on. That ain't saying muskies are bad. It's just, you know, you get enough of this or that, it's really a good idea to, you know, like I mentioned, keyholes. You want to look through as many as your lifetime allows. Most anglers look over the keyhole and they're afraid to leave for fear they can't find it or somebody else will get it. And, you know, you look and you see green, or you look this way and you see stripes or this or that. And the truth is, it's all, that's, they're both there. You got to look through 100 holes to get a 3D view, though, you know. And a lot of anglers are afraid to sort of branch out. Just try it. Just try it. See what it is you like the best till you, a lot of people, I like this. Well, I never tried that. Try it all. It's all good.
You know, Larry, you've been everywhere. You fished everywhere. Obviously, I can tell that you're a very analytical angler. Like, what is it that you feel separates you from most anglers, though? Because obviously, you've had success in many different areas, many different species.
Well, I texted you a word. Did you get, you got that right?
I did. Yes, I even looked it up.
Yeah, that's what makes me probably different. I don't believe anything. I don't believe it unless I see it like several times. I'm just so not superstitious. You can't believe how not superstitious I am. When fish are biting good, I try to find something they won't bite to find out if what I'm using mattered. You know, was it in the right place, the right time? But no, I just have no superstition. And just, you know, people say patience. I have no patience. It's easy to confuse a relentlessness with patience. As I've gotten older, you know, I'm not quite as relentless, because I answered a lot of the questions that I was concerned about that were driving me nuts. But I think it's just looking at it from try to look at it from the way a fish sees things rather than the way that I see things. And then I like to be able to watch those rascals. I like to be able to watch them. You know, a lot of times I just go and just watch them.
You know, I mean, this will be directed at both you two, I guess. Like, the one thing, Brad and Larry, is I can obviously tell whenever I'm talking to, you know, what I consider to be a legend in fishing. It's like, for me, I really enjoy fishing. I'm passionate about fishing. But for a Larry, I can just tell, like, fishing is kind of like your oxygen. It's like something you have to do. And I think that separates a lot of you from many, many anglers as well. I think many of us are passionate about it, but we just don't have that exact same desire that you have. It's remarkable.
Part of it too, you know, that's a good point, but you know, part of it is opportunity. And this is kind of sad. When I was a little kid in a little town of 931 people, dogs ran free and so did little kids. And I was allowed at age 5, 6 to go down to this little reservoir. It was a block or so from my house. I had to wear a life jacket at that age, but you didn't have to worry about being kidnapped or anything. So I could go down there every single morning when the frogs were chirping and the fog was coming up and nobody else was awake, and you didn't have to worry about it. And I was given the opportunity to be there, to be on the water every single day, day after day. As a teenager, I was on the water 1,500 hours a summer. You'd go do the math on, you know, how long our summers are. That's opportunity. And some kid today, if you got to fish, just think, every weekend, pull day. What is that? 8 days a month? That isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got it, you know. And then the other thing, jumping around. It's good to go to a body of water and be there seasonally until you got a good feel for it, instead of jumping all over the place. And, oh, the fish aren't biting here. They exist. They're not biting. Or what do you mean they're not? And there's times, of course, that fish are not biting, but usually you are not where they are biting. If that's the problem.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that then, you know, like breaking down new water or a new angler. So if you're a new angler, you'd obviously recommend that they basically pick a lake and stick to it for the course of an entire season until they have it learned. I'm assuming that's based off what your statement was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I do And what I would say is you break it down in your own head, you know, like I think there's certain mechanics, right, of boat. It's got to do with the things you can control, how you run your boat and how you, you know, control and can I execute, right? It's got to do with casting a lure, feeling a lure, setting a hook, fighting a few. There's mechanics involved with things. And then you've got a strategy, like where am I going to fish? Where are the places fish might be? You break them down. You look at a lake. In some lakes, there might be many different types of options. Other lakes might be just some sort of a bowl with a rim of vegetation around it. Well, you know, you break it down. And then there are certain tactics that can be executed to break it down physically. It's like rubbing the silver off a lottery card. Do I do it with a jig? Do I do it with a crankbait? Do I do it with a this or a that? And then it comes down to your own ability to execute that tactic with whatever that lure was, you know. If you can throw a crankbait from here to Piccadilly, you can, you know, brine it in 8-10 feet of water in the bottom and maybe, you know, find a bunch of bass way, way quicker than you'd ever find them with a jig worm or a whatever. But anyway, when I do that, you know, you've got a box of tools. That's what your tactics are. And you, you know, you go scrub around. When I go to a new place, okay, how fast can my boat go? How much territory can I cover in the time I have? I have 6 or 7 days here to fish. And in a day, what's reasonable? So you go rip around. And then I would assign the values. Typically, in our part of the world, depending on what time of the year it is, you know, what way I break things down, where are the main lake basins? Where are the shelves? Which one do they use to spawn? You know, what is the forage here? What's the cycle of the forage? What substrate and what, you know, level, what shelf, you know, level do they operate on seasonally? And then you go rub the silver out of the lottery card. And if you can see the damn things, then you can figure out what it is that makes them tick sometimes, you know. And then you got fish that eat bugs. You got fish that eat each other. You got fish that eat each other. When you look at their teeth, that tells you a little bit. If pike, musky, so on and so on, usually there is a handful of triggers. You get fish that eat bugs. The triggers are 180 from the fish that eat each other. That becomes mostly spatial. But if you could see them, that helps really a lot to get the tactical side down, for me anyway. And then you got the part that is also very interesting and important, especially in the predator side. Part of the role of a top pyramid fish is natural selection. That means if there's something that doesn't really belong here, something that is misborn, I'm going to get rid of it. I'm going to eat it. As opposed to, gee, the fish are feeding on this or that. I need to imitate that, right? That's why, if we're raising catfish, there might be hundreds of white ones that are very, very small when they're first born. But those white catfish would be the first ones to be eaten by predators because they stand out, and that's part of natural selection. And a lot of times, some lure with some weird color or something that's so out of place gets reacted to because of the instinct of natural selection. And then that's another side too, and that's got to do with fish are born samplers. If you a school of minnows at the dock or a school of sunfish next time you're at your pier, you take a worm or an insect or a booger out of your nose and throw it in the water and they'll eat it and sample it and they'll keep sampling it because it's a successful sample of protein. Take a piece of gum, brightly colored, whatever, you know, make it look like a worm. Throw it in and they'll sample it and boop, spit it out, sample, boop, and then they'll quit sampling it. After they have sampled it unsuccessfully a couple of times, they say, uh-uh. But when they first see it, they'll sample it. And I think fish go through life with the sampling process. And things that exhibit various qualities that they sampled successfully may get sampled again. And as the fish becomes simply more mature, that list of options, of course, becomes smaller.
And it's unreal. Like some of the thoughts and things that you produce in my head are it's just crazy. Love to go down, you know, further on it. Obviously, you know, we try to have respect for our guests and their time. But, you know, before we let you get out of here, Larry, and I certainly appreciate your time. You've hunted down big fish and you've hunted down muskies. I have two questions, actually. First one is, what do you think the key is to catching the biggest muskie in the system? You know, like, is it weather? Is it moon? What is it?
No, neither of those for me. It's fooling him into biting what you are using. And, you know, a lot of that for me, that's why I spend a lot of time, you know, messing around in my workshop. Also, each time, muskies are really interesting. And they're one of the reasons we all come back to what our childhood, that first thing, you know, that as anglers, what we did as children, it always filters back to that. I've interviewed a lot of anglers and it's the same. It always does. Those were some of my early eyes. But muskies are interesting because they follow, which I think makes them sort of special. It makes one muskie can service several anglers, you know, as opposed to a pike that comes up and bites and, you know, would be gone. Each time you visit, after he follows and you continue to harass him, it will make him more difficult to catch the next time you visit. And deciding when you've been busted is really important. And setting up so you are not as likely to get busted is very important, I think. I think cuspatorial periods are far more important than any of this other stuff. Predators have an advantage during the cuspatorial periods because their eyes adjust to the shift from light to dark, dark to light, more quickly than the prey. And the morning and evenings are the times that are most likely. And what's beautiful about it is, you know, there's one every day. I mean, you know, one in the morning, one in the evening. There's two of them every day. But the other stuff, and I kept track of that for a long, long time. And when you have a moon phase that all positive can coincides with the sunrise and the sunset or the pre-dawn, you know, and the post-dawn. But a lot of it also depends upon humans. If you got a lot of humans wrapping around, you know, during the daytime, people are skiing and dink, then you got to turn into a night stalker. So a lot of it has to do with whether there's humans harassing them too.
So you mentioned, you know, weather and the moon weren't like real high in your priority
yeah,
list.
Yeah, the weather could be really helpful, you know, especially understanding how to read any weather you got. You know, the weather's the weather. And there are certain weather conditions where they get stupid. There's no doubt. But I sure don't. Well, you know, I don't wait for the, you know, pray for the weather because I know they are where they are, not where I wish them to be necessarily. And if I go, you know, do the right dance, you know, you can get them to cooperate times.
Well, the other thing we talk about a lot on this podcast is patterning. You know, like if you're, I don't know, let's just say you chose a crankbait to start the day off. How long do you stick with that crankbait before you're either changing up to a different bait or a different color? And would you change baits or colors first, I guess?
To me, a pattern is systematic and predictable arrangement of fish based upon certain types of environment. In other words, a pattern is wind-blown rock points extending out of the main lake basin. That to me is what a pattern is. The lure itself, color is the least important. What I'm looking for in with fish and muskies is, I need to know, you know, depth, obviously. Where am I? What part of the water am I fishing? But speed and size, and whether I'm throwing something that's suspending or doing a real wide. Where I'm moving, how can I say, when the distance that the lure has moved toward me is 10 feet, but the distance the lure has actually traveled in the water might be more like 30, that type of lure. versus a lure that is when I move it 10 feet, it's coming at me right at 10 feet. That would have more to do with weather happened to be. I'd just be, trying to figure out where there's a fish and then get him to look at what I'm throwing without him knowing I'm after him.
Yeah. Awesome. Very interesting stuff. Brad, do you have anything else you want to cover here today?
I don't know about today. Our time was kind of up, but honestly, I think we should have Larry back on and dig into some of these different topics that we kind of touched on today.
Well, he'll blow a lot of people's minds. I know that.
Now, Brad, you start messing around with some of that, what I was talking about with a different material, the rubber and the urethane blades. You'll find it really interesting.
For sure. I mean, you showed me years ago. Actually, I can take you right down to my bench and you see one of the blades that you made me years ago.
You're kidding me. You got to be kidding me.
No, it's still there. I can send you a picture. It's pretty funny because the very first one you made, I can't remember. I mean, it's got to be close to our 13 blade that we have. It's a giant blade. It's one of your urethane blades, and you put some Mylar inside it, so it does reflect. It's kind of an amber color. It's really cool.
Yeah, it was probably a concept thing at that time. I don't. That's some of the when I was first probably messing with it. Man, that goes back. How do we get so old so fast?
I don't know, man, but it goes quick, doesn't it?
Gosh, it sure does. I'm having flashbacks now. I'm having a flashback. I'm having a flashback of you with this great big damn vacuum cleaner. And I'm pulling up at your place, and you got this big vacuum cleaner in this great big Ranger. And you are just vacuuming the heck out of the carpet. And I can't remember if it was because there was all these strands of flashing blue or if it was what. But I had never seen a man in a boat with a vacuum cleaner.
The old Hoover.
Was that really?
Yeah, I think it was.
Hoover. Oh, man. Good memories, Brad.
Absolutely, Larry. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on. And like I said, I really do think that we need to do it again. If you're open to that, I know that we'd have you again. That's for sure.
Well, it's always good hearing from you. And, whatever you guys want to do, if I'm still right on command, I'm happy to do whatever I can within reason.
Well, we greatly appreciate it, Larry.
Yep.
Everyone, good talking to you. You guys have a really good day. And we'll be fishing here a little bit, right?
It won't be long now. Well, Larry, we want to thank you for your time, and we also want to thank our listeners for tuning in again for another episode, and we'll be back with another one again next week, Wednesday. Thank you, Larry. We really appreciate it.
And more than welcome. See you guys.